We're talking about Wisconsin resources for pregnant people in a post-Roe world with our state's 173-year-old abortion ban in effect. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. Women's Medical Fund is a volunteer nonprofit founded in 1976 to help residents who cannot afford the entire cost of an abortion. Another Madison-based volunteer nonprofit has a much more recent history, goes by the acronym POWERS, Pregnancy Options Wisconsin Education Resources and Support, connects people to a coalition of volunteer doctors, doulas, educators, and activists. Join in on the future of these organizations, what you want to know about their work, 800-642-1234. Ingrid Anderson co-founded POWERS 3 years ago, is a nurse midwife for over 20 years. Ingrid, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much.
And Lucy Marshall is here, president of Women's Medical Fund. Lucy, welcome to you.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Well, let's make space for both of your reactions to the ruling 2 weeks ago. There's been some time to process the Supreme Court overturning a constitutional right to an abortion. And Lucy, your fund supported 1,500 people, I believe, receiving abortions last year. What have you been thinking about?
Absolutely. Of course, the ruling is devastating, and it's so heartbreaking to see the immediate impact it's had on folks wanting to access abortion in our state, like same day of the ruling, needing to coordinate folks who are supposed to have appointments in Wisconsin, needing to move to a different state. It's really disheartening to see the barriers that were already so high in Wisconsin just continue to add up. And I'm feeling so grateful for the outpouring of support from Wisconsin residents really across the state, and the ways that the Abortion Fund, WMF, and our partners like POWERS have really anticipated and been ready for this moment to ensure that we're able to support people right away in accessing the care and the abortion funding that they need, because really Roe was always the floor and not the ceiling. So many people in Wisconsin lived in what felt like a post-Roe world already. And so we're prepared and committed to ensuring people can continue to access abortion despite, you know, these mounting barriers.
Lucy, you said you've received an outpouring of support since the ruling. Can you go a little bit deeper there? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, we've received so many generous donations from people across the state as well as across the country. We're a member of the National Network of Abortion Funds, which has run a campaign directly to support abortion funds in states where abortion is now banned or illegal or highly restricted. And we also have a lot of new faces who are hoping to volunteer and get involved and connected to the movement for abortion access. We're really grateful, and we know that the resources are so, so needed. Like the need for abortion funding was already increasing. Between 2020 and 2021, we saw a 30% increase in our abortion funding support, and we were on track to exceed that significantly already with Roe in 2022. So we know that the resources are needed. They're going directly to support people in traveling and coordinating their abortion care, in paying for their abortion appointments, and for creating new infrastructure in our state, including supporting POWERS as an information and resource hub for pregnant folks in Wisconsin.
Ingrid, as a nurse midwife for decades, where are you at with this decision that was handed down?
Well, very much in alignment with how Lucy described reactions in the landscape. But for healthcare workers such as myself, we've been on the front lines of reproductive bodies for some time and seen greater restrictions, greater stigmas imposed. And so for us, in some senses in the trenches, It's welcoming to have everybody recognize the police state for what it is, in terms of abortion in particular, just how restricted Wisconsin was already, placed such burdens and obstacles, particularly on people who are already burdened in life, low-income people, people traveling from great distances, because the only place left to have an abortion in Wisconsin was Madison, Milwaukee, and Sheboygan. For people of color, for LGBTQ plus people. So for more people to be really facing the reality that we're in, where there are only 22 safe states left, and anybody in Wisconsin needs to look outside of our whole state for full spectrum pregnancy options is outrageous, and a lot of people are grieving and traumatized, and that's just for many people who are not even freely choosing abortion, but must have a termination for medical reasons because they have a fetus that is non-viable. That's just heaping grief and trauma on experiences that are already so difficult. So
what do you think will happen with ectopic pregnancies in this abortion ban in Wisconsin?
Well, an ectopic pregnancy can be a situation that does endanger the life of the mother. And so under this 1849 law, it is legal to help terminate a pregnancy when the life of the mother is endangered. But anything short of that requires folks to look out of state for an abortion. So we at Powers, are able to support folks through all their pregnancy options. Of course, at this time, nearly all of our calls, which have gone up from maybe 10 a month to 10 a day, so we've seen an astronomical increase, are all, of course, surrounding abortion access. And so we are sort of a clearinghouse, a hub for the up-to-date information about who's doing what, where, and how to access those resources.
But as you said, that abortion available for a life-saving emergency, I think a central question right now is who gets to decide what counts as a life-saving emergency, and how might someone in that particular emergency in a state with no abortion providers because abortion is a crime, or in a state where there's just a handful of providers because there's a ban on the books, how can that be fulfilled in the law?
Proving that...
It seems like such a gray area of, life-saving emergency for a pregnant person, and that in a state that has already banned abortion, that seems to be even more tricky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. And practitioners are always weighing the balance of their license and their profession in comparison to those the risks. And so I think so much remains to be determined, right? But what we know legally right now is that we can share information, we can help people find out where they need to go, how to get it paid for, how to get logistic help like childcare, transportation, housing if needed. Most folks are going to Minnesota or Illinois right now, and we have a really strong collaborations and partnerships built up with those organizations. Powers is also working very closely with Women's Medical Fund to ensure that Wisconsin dollars follow Wisconsin people who, wherever they are going to access abortion.
I want to jump in here. Lucy Marshall, president of Women's Medical Fund, it seems like nonprofits like yours, these volunteer networks, are really working now on the logistics as people look to travel out of their home state for abortion care. Are you seeing that these organizations are shifting and changing to meet new priorities?
In some ways, of course, we're seeing significant changes because we lost 4 abortion clinics that we had in our state. And in other ways, we're doing a lot of the same work we were doing because people already had to travel to only 4 abortion clinics that serve the entire state. So the reality is that the Midwest especially had already created infrastructures of care and coordination to support people in travel costs and coordination, hotel stay, childcare. And of course, these barriers just increase when people need to travel even further distances, which is what's happening now. When we're talking about the need for funding, the costs of an abortion are one thing. They increase when you wait later or are forced to wait later in pregnancy to have an abortion. And then the costs of missing work, additional childcare, all of the travel expenses really add up and make abortion an even greater barrier. Not to mention that so many folks around the Midwest and beyond, even farther in the country, are also traveling to the same few states that have protected access to abortion. So Illinois and Minnesota are already seeing people coming from farther and farther away. Definitely the folks in those states are needing the extra support, and we're happy to be partnering with them and ensure that Wisconsin residents have the funding that they need in those states to make sure, you know, every gap is filled to the best of our ability.
We have Lucy Marshall and Ingrid Anderson with us on the Future of Reproductive Care in Wisconsin. What they're seeing as volunteer resource providers now that the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. Lucy leads the Women's Medical Fund. Ingrid co-founded Powers or Pregnancy Options Wisconsin. Join in on their work. What is on your mind about the health care, its future in our state? 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. We're discussing how pregnancy resource nonprofits operate now, where an 1849 abortion ban had been unenforceable in our state, but that all changed 2 weeks ago. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer. Kent, Governor Evers said he was prepared to fight Wisconsin's ban, vowing to give clemency to doctors, talking with WISN-TV the day Roe was overturned.
We're going back to pre-Civil War, for God's sakes, when that was put in place. It's an archaic law. So we're looking at every option that's on the table.
Join in how you see community resource organizations that work in this space, what their role is now. 800-642-1234. Nurse midwife Ingrid Anderson co-founded Pregnancy Options Wisconsin. Lucy Marshall here leads the Women's Medical Fund, and they're with us for about 7 more minutes. You mentioned that there is this uptick in call volume. And Ingrid, I want to pose this to you first with a 24/7 helpline. Walk us through, how long does an average call last? Is there a typical call?
I would say the average call lasts 3 to 5 minutes. The typical call is used to be how to get help paying for abortion, because it is upwards of $650 now, more if the abortion is later. And then, as Lucy mentioned, there can be added childcare, transportation, loss of work costs. That has changed, I would say, since June 24th in the fall of Roe, to being calls all over the spectrum, I would say, need for emotional support, folks, menopausal women who had abortions years ago and are just in a state of shock and needing to talk to somebody to feel like their lives of activism weren't all a waste. I've heard from men as well, have heard a lot of tears on the phone about just where we're at in history going backwards. Folks just needing logistical support. Where do I go? It is not the 1960s. It is a completely different world with so many networks up and running. And even Powers, as of July 1st, has 2 paid staff positions to staff phones and to continue this networking work so that we can offer callers the most updated, streamlined information and connect them. So abortionfinder.org, for example, if people want to find the clinic closest to them, is an updated, great website to know about. And in Minnesota and Illinois, where most Wisconsinites are going, and frankly, the Wisconsinites who have been living along the borders of Minnesota and Illinois have already been going for many years because those are more abortion supportive, I would say, pregnant people supportive, states. So in Illinois, rjustice.net is an important website to know about. And in Illinois, chicagoabortionfund.org is an important one. And they help not only with paying for abortion, and they're in partnership with Women's Medical Fund as well, but they can help with all logistic needs that folks from Wisconsin might have.
Lucy, privacy also has become a huge topic of concern as women are now shown how to cover their tracks and not leave a digital footprint. What type of information do you take down and, you know, about a person who calls, and how do you advise on privacy?
You're right that privacy and security is more and more important. It's always been important, and now with such a heightened risk of state violence, honestly, we understand this extreme priority both for those who are receiving abortion funding and abortion care, and also our volunteers and leaders who, want to ensure our safety for each other and our care for each other. WMF does not collect any information that we don't need. So really, we collect information directly from the clinics. It's de-identified. We just know how many people are funded, how much money they received. I think we collect their age and zip code. And all of that is just for us to get a sense of the needs, ensure that the entire state is accessing our support so we can identify any barriers. And we don't want to put any extra burden on folks who need abortion funding, you know, to provide all this extra information that is not necessary to collect, and also, of course, to protect their privacy and safety.
Talking with Pregnancy Resource Center's Lucy Marshall, their president at Women's Medical Fund. Ingrid Anderson with us of Pregnancy Options Wisconsin. Join in 800-642-1234. Ingrid, you gave several websites there. Crisis pregnancy centers, they've been operating for a long time. They've been criticized for misleading pregnant people and spreading claims about the dangers of abortions. How do you view the tensions around these centers that are called crisis pregnancy resource centers?
Yes, thank you, Kate, for that question. And they have largely changed their names to women's health centers, which sort of speaks to a shift in focus in responding to the charge of being a fake health center. So they do offer free ultrasounds and some basic health care, but it's very misleading and a little trickier to navigate or might say devious, more devious than ever to navigate, because portraying themselves as women health centers, they lead pregnant people to believe that they can find information and support for all their options. And really, they do not offer morning after pills. They do not offer any abortion information or access. In fact, they, you know, we know from firsthand reports that they dissuade people from considering abortion, anything other than carrying the pregnancy to term. And even to the point where when they do a dating ultrasound, sort of fudge the dates to make the pregnancy seem later and less safe for an abortion than it might actually be. So we have a big problem with those. There are lots of them through rural Wisconsin in particular. Also, they tend to be located across the clinics that offer abortion health care.
And we have to end there. Thank you both for joining us. Ingrid Anderson, nurse midwife, co-founded Pregnancy Options Wisconsin. Lucy Marshall, president of Women's Medical Fund in Madison. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about lessons learned from the Turnaway study and how it might inform what states do about abortion access in a post-Roe environment. You're with us for The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The study was a large, long-term body of research that followed the mental health and other indicators of nearly 1,000 women in 21 states who sought abortions. It dug deeply into this key central question: what happens when a person seeking an abortion is turned away? Join in on what the research says, what you want to know about the Turnaway study. Perhaps you read the book. 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Diana Green Foster is a professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive sciences at the Bixby Center at the University of California, San Francisco. She was lead researcher on the team behind the Turnaway study. Diana, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me, Kate.
Well, let's just make space now for your reaction to the fall of Roe. What have you been processing? What have you been thinking about?
I mean, we certainly knew it was likely to come from that leak, and still it's been something of a shock, just because it's such a radical change from what our country has been talking about abortion for the past 50 years. So I'm super concerned. I'm really worried that this bill, this change will enable states to make it, you know, much harder for people to get abortions. And that's the outcomes that we see in the Turnaway study are what people will experience when they're unable to get a wanted abortion.
What I hear in the Turnaway study again and again from you is that you have to talk to people directly. You have to hear them out. You have to follow up and check over a course of time. Research takes time. Mm-hmm. When you look at the culmination of all those surveys, of all those interviews, what is the biggest myth that exists about abortion?
I think that we have this idea that abortion is something people do because they're irresponsible. They're irresponsible in having gotten pregnant, and then they're somehow doing something rash to end that pregnancy. And it's just not what we find. We find a lot of people were using contraception in the month they became pregnant. And people, when they're trying to make the decision what to do with a pregnancy that they weren't planning, they're weighing all of their own responsibilities and their own aspirations. So when we ask them, why did you want this abortion? They give us reasons that they can't afford to have a child or to have another child, that their relationship with the man involved isn't good enough, that their health isn't good enough, that they want to take care of the kids they already have, that they want to achieve other life plans first. And on all of those, we see that they're right, because when we follow people who are denied abortions, all of those concerns describe their experience. They become poorer. Their relationship isn't good enough to support a child. Their existing children do worse. Their health is worse. So I think what we learn in the study is that we can trust people's decision-making. And when they're unable to get the decision, when they're unable to get an abortion, when they decide they want one, their outcomes are worse and their kids' outcomes are worse.
The CDC's surveillance data says the majority of abortions in 2019, most recent data, you're a demographer, you look at data all day long, you know, that the majority of abortions took place in early in gestation, 92.7% of abortions, first trimester. What did you find out? What were reasons you found people seeking abortions when the pregnancy is further along?
Yeah, so the whole design of the study required that people be up near the limit of the clinic, that because some of them were too far along and others were just under. So it was the first study to really look at why someone would be late in seeking an abortion. And what we see is that it's often the case that people didn't realize they were pregnant. And that can happen because people don't have symptoms, because they have other chronic conditions, or they just gave birth, and so their body has symptoms in common with pregnancy. Or they were using contraception, so they thought they were protected from the risk of pregnancy. And when you're a little late in discovering you're pregnant, then all of the logistical barriers snowball. You know, all of a sudden you have to travel farther, take more time off work, pay more. And so people become even later. That's primarily the story of how people end up seeking abortion after the first trimester. But then the study explicitly excluded people who had fetal diagnoses or maternal health reasons for abortion of like imminent risk of death. And so those people also are disproportionately late.
What impact on the people you talked with, what impact did mandatory waiting periods have, or, repeat ultrasounds or layers of logistical costs? What about those impacts?
Yeah, so it wasn't the primary goal to explore all these restrictions that changed the practice of providing abortions. But the government has gotten involved in like mandating that people wait before their appointment, or mandate that they have an ultrasound, be offered a view of their ultrasound. So we were able to explore how people experienced all of these. I think those restrictions are passed with somehow the idea that they improve people, the experience, but that is generally not what we find. We find that when there's a 24-hour waiting period, often that ends up being in more than a week delay, because people have to then make many trips and take time off work. And so what seems like a small delay ends up being a large delay. We see that people generally don't mind viewing their ultrasound if they've chosen to view their ultrasound, but that when they didn't choose to view their ultrasound, it doesn't improve their experience. So there's no need to mandate that people view it, because people who want to view it to help in their decision making or to come to terms with what they're doing, those people can opt in. And then also there are some states that mandate that people be told things that are scientifically inaccurate about the risk of abortion. So for example, there are some states that tell people that abortion is associated with suicidality or depression. And people who end up hearing those messages, not surprisingly, find that the counseling is less helpful.
What about the message of, you're going to regret this decision, or this idea that an abortion disrupts their lives for a long time, perhaps forever? What did you hear there?
So there's a range of emotional experience after an abortion. The most common emotion is relief, but there are some people who experience negative emotions like sadness or regret. But when we follow people over time, more than 95% say that the decision to have an abortion was the right one for them. And even the people who say they feel the emotion regret, 90% of them say that the abortion was the right decision. Because I think you can feel the emotion regret. I regret I was in a position where I needed to do this. I regret that, you know, my family wasn't as supportive as I wanted. I regret whatever. But it doesn't mean that you didn't feel that it doesn't mean that you didn't feel you made the right decision. So we find that although there's a range of emotion over time, what people say is that they've stopped thinking about the abortion. And the only time they think about it is when we call them for these interviews.
I want to slow that down and make sure that we take that in, because your group found over 95% of the people who did get an abortion in the participants in your study said it had been the right choice when you talked with them 5 years out. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, that's right. And could I say, though, that it's also true that people who are denied the abortion, most of those people also say that they were glad they were denied. And I think that that has is super interesting. And it's partly that people want to say that their life turned out for the best. Mm. And it's partly that it's not really acceptable to have a child and say you wish they weren't born. But we see that their outcomes are measurably worse on many different fronts, economically, physical health, relationships, and yet they still say that they, it's slightly less, but still most of them say that they're glad they were turned away. So I think we should keep that in our mind too. People are very emotionally resilient, and the people who are least likely to say that they're glad they were denied the abortion is actually the people who place the child for adoption, which I think is consistent with this, with the idea that placing a child for adoption is not a very easy thing to do. It's a very difficult thing to do.
We have UC San Francisco professor and demographer Diana Green Foster, who led the Turnaway study. You can join in with questions about the study and what it yielded. 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. You know, what do you think that the Turnaway study can tell lawmakers? How can it inform policy?
Yeah. I think whether you're supportive or opposed to abortion rights, that there's something to be learned from the Turnaway study, which is that when people are unable to get what they want in terms of a pregnancy, when they're unable to get an abortion and end an unwanted pregnancy, that they're worse off in ways that we can see. And therefore, if we restrict access to abortion, a lot of effort needs to be made to mitigating those harms. Because even people who are opposed to abortion, or especially people who are opposed to abortion, it's not that they want an increase in child poverty, but that's what will happen. And so a lot of effort needs to be made. What we see is that the existing children of people who are denied abortions are more likely to be in poverty, less likely to hit developmental milestones. Something needs to be done. If abortion is restricted, efforts need to be made to help children and to help low-income parents so that they don't spend their children's early years not having enough money for basic living needs like food and housing, because that is what we see in the data. We see that people who are denied abortions are more likely to experience poverty, and it's not just immediate, it lasts for years. We see greater debt and lower employment and just greater economic hardship.
Diana Green Foster, demographer at UC San Francisco, led the Turnaway study looking at the health and well-being of women who seek abortion, including both women who do and do not receive one over a 10-year span. Join in on the research, What You Wonder, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kemp. Let's get back to our conversation with UC San Francisco demographer and professor Diana Green Foster. Since the fall of Roe, her Turnaway study has been in the headlines. This was the long-term study that documented what happened to women who are unable to obtain an abortion. Over a decade, her research team tracked life outcomes of nearly 1,000 women. Still time to talk about this research, 800-642-1234. Diana Green Foster with us for about 11 more minutes. Let's take Anna Lisa in Green Bay. Hi, Anna Lisa. What would you like to bring up?
Well, I would just like to support what the speaker said, that the expenses incurred with childbearing, it's not just about diapers. And that's what I hear these pro-life people saying, well, we'll provide diapers and things like that. Well, the expense of having a child goes on for at least 18 years. And so I find that totally insufficient when they keep telling us that they've got diapers available. Thank you.
Thank you, Annalisa. Diana, go ahead there on the expenses and costs.
Yeah, Annalisa is clearly right. And it's not just economics. It's even people who want a child, another child. Having a child from a pregnancy under bad circumstances results in worse outcomes. So it's if someone who wants another child can decide that this pregnancy is not the right pregnancy and decide to have another child later with a better partner, with better economic circumstances, with more stable housing, for example. And so just enabling people to dictate that, to control the timing of their births, enables them to have more economic security, to have a more supportive environment for a child. So really it is about, it's not just that children are expensive, it's about when somebody feels that the circumstances of this pregnancy aren't good, that there are particular economic costs to having to carry that pregnancy to term.
You've received pushback on the study, your study itself. Researchers like at, you know, Bowling Green State University, the professor there said your study is flawed because it is unclear how you decided who to include in it. What is your response?
I'm glad you brought it up. We're writing a response to that article now. But it, we were very clear that the people were not approached based on their attitudes about the pregnancy. And so the accusations are not accurate. There's that it's, you know, the people who wrote that are ideologically opposed to abortion and have done their own very discredited work. So not particularly concerned about the critiques that they raise, because the study has been fully vetted by the scientific community by 50 peer-reviewed papers. So I know that the science is good, and I understand that people who don't like some of the results aren't happy with it, but it doesn't make it not true.
Was it difficult to keep these women in the study, to keep track of them over years? People move, you can get out of touch. Was that difficult?
Yes, it's always a challenge. And I think it's the case that one shouldn't only use a study where people have to opt into participating in interviews and where you have to keep them over time. It's critically important to talk to people and hear about their experience. But that kind of study is, of course, vulnerable to losing people over time, because that's what happens when you do a longitudinal study. And so we can check our results with other data sets that don't rely on people agreeing to be called every 6 months and continuing to participate over time. And when we do compare our study results to other data sets, either medical record reviews or registry data from other countries, we find our results are absolutely consistent with other data sets.
There's been such a focus now on moving toward privacy as well. Women covering up their digital footprints. Will this type of research become, will that be barriers in the future to this type of research?
Oh, that's such an interesting question. I don't know whether people's worry about the government monitoring their pregnancies will affect people's willingness to participate in this, in a study like mine. We're actually right now gearing up to study the end of Roe, including among people in Wisconsin. So we've recruited people who were the last served in Wisconsin and Alabama and a few other states, the last provided their wanted abortions. And then people who either had appointments on the books or called after the clinic closed, to see how those two groups, those who were last served in their state, those who were the first turned away, how they fared over time. And what we, what we're doing to address this issue that you're have raised about privacy is that we're making it so that giving any identifying information is completely optional, so that people don't have to disclose their name and birthday, for example, if they aren't comfortable doing so. So we'll see whether, you know, we're right now recruiting for this study, and we'll see if a lot of people decide not to tell us their name as they participate.
It's really interesting how you are flexing based on the times, based on the developments of our times, flexing your research to study what is happening right now, and capturing this data that could shift and change. How difficult is that to, unless you were ramping up like that before, to me that it would be difficult for a researcher to be that responsive. I mean, part of research is got to go out and find the funding first, the grants.
Yes. Yeah. I love the idea that we were flexing. It felt more like panicking. But we did actually start long ago. We started back in November trying to figure out what questions to ask. And also, I want the Turnaway study, many scientists from across the country worked on it, but I had this idea with this new study, this end of Roe study, that we would have a national collaboration at the very start. So I've been working with faculty at the University of Wisconsin and many other universities to make sure that I'm using the expertise that has already been developed in designing the questions and making sure that we ask the right questions to look at. And this new study, it's not just about birth versus abortion. Really, this new study is, who is it who circumvents their state laws when their state bans abortion? What lengths do people go to? Who's unable to do that? Who tries something dangerous? Who gets good information and gets a safe abortion in time? And then who carries a pregnancy to term? So it's really more about the process. And I've managed to get scientists from across the country to weigh in at the beginning.
Talking with Diana Green Foster of the Turnaway study, where her research heads next on abortion services, how it affects women's lives. She's a professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive sciences at UC San Francisco. Still time for you to join in, 800-642-1234. Diana, we don't know the full effect of the decision for some time, and Wisconsin's 1849 law, you know, that too will take time. Research, as you have just suggested, takes time. But based on what you have seen from the Turnaway study and the things that you saw there, can you make some predictions of what could happen in this patchwork environment for reproductive rights in America? What do you see ahead?
So what I'm very concerned about is what we see in the Turnaway study is that people who seek abortions are already disproportionately poor. And when people are denied abortions, they become even poorer. And I'm really concerned with the end of Roe that the burden of laws that restrict people's decision-making around pregnancy will fall on the harm of those will disproportionately fall on the poorest people. The poorest people, the people with health conditions and disabilities, minors and immigrants, that people who are vulnerable personally or legally will experience the greatest hardships. And I think we need to watch out for that. I think we need to be concerned about the well-being of people who aren't able to get around their state's laws. And maybe don't get good information about how to end a pregnancy and try something, you know, dangerous. I'm hoping that doesn't happen, because now there are medication abortion pills that people could order online and have a safe abortion. And that's much better than doing something dangerous. You know, trying to end a pregnancy with other substances that can be very harmful. So that's what I'm watching for, and that's what I'm concerned about.
We only have a few seconds left, but when might you turn some reliable data on what you would find in Wisconsin and elsewhere in this new study?
We won't wait for, we'll try and get the results out as soon as we can, in terms of trying to identify people who are at risk, who need more information or more resources to avoid poor outcomes. We will not sit on those data, because we're really designing this data to help inform harm mitigation strategies. So it's not just academic with this, it's really trying to safeguard people's health and well-being.
Diana, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Diana Green Foster, professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive sciences at UC San Francisco, led the Turnaway study, wrote a book on it in 2020. Earlier, we heard from Lucy Marshall, head of the Women's Medical Fund, and Ingrid Anderson, co-founder of Pregnancy Options Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.